of the United States government.
This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports the White House is warning Israel would hand Hamas a major win by staging a full-scale assault on Rafah.
President Biden has threatened to halt more offensive aid to Israel if it goes through with a major operation in Rafah, and his efforts to reach a ceasefire continue.
Any kind of major Rafah ground operation would actually strengthen Hamas's hands at the negotiating table, not Israel's.
White House National Security spokesman John Kirby says more civilian deaths in Rafah would only help Hamas's leader make a case against Israel.
More ammunition for his twisted narrative here.
It's unclear if the president's threat to withhold aid would change Israel's calculus. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will stand alone if need be. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Russian President Vladimir Putin accused the West Thursday of risking a global conflict and said no one would be allowed to threaten the world's biggest nuclear power as Russia marked the Soviet Union's victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony.
Despite unseasonably cold weather and snow, crowds of Russians gathered in the center of Moscow to watch the Victory Day parade. The Soviet Union lost 27 million people in World War II, including many millions in Ukraine. But this year, the parade was pared down, indicating strains born from more than 2 years of war in Ukraine. Ukraine and the West say Putin is engaged in an imperial-style land grab. Russian officials warn that the Ukraine war is entering the most dangerous phase to date, and Putin has repeatedly warned of the risk of the war broadening out to involve the world's biggest nuclear powers.
That is Reuters' Lauren Anthony reporting. You'll find more at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Yemen's Houthi rebels Thursday claimed responsibility for two missile attacks in the Gulf of Aden on two Panama-flag container ships that caused no damage. Meanwhile, advisor to Iran's supreme leader again threatened that Tehran could build a nuclear weapon if it chose to pursue atomic armaments. In a stunning show of unity in the often divided House, Democrats in the U.S. joined a majority of Republicans on Wednesday to save the GOP for Speaker from an attempt to fellow Republican Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to remove him from his post. But while Democrats in the minority threw the Louisiana congressman a life raft by voting on his side, they made clear they might not do so again. That means the threat for Johnson still lingers, as Greene and other lawmakers can at any time call up for another motion to oust him. Stormy Daniels delivered shocking testimony about Donald Trump, but the trial hinges on business records. AP correspondent Mike Sisak reports the defense sought another mistrial, arguing that Stormy Daniels' testimony was prejudicial.
The testimony, according to Trump lawyer Todd Blanche, amounted to a dog whistle for rape. But Daniels made clear in her testimony that her encounter that she says happened with Trump, that it was consensual. The prosecution said that the details that she offered were necessary to prove her contention that there was a sexual encounter and to show the motivation for Trump years later to want that story suppressed.
That's AP correspondent Mike Sisak reporting. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports on a key ruling in the Hunter Biden gun case.
A request to dismiss the federal gun case against Hunter Biden has been rejected by an appeals court in Philadelphia. A three-member panel of the court said it doesn't have jurisdiction to review the matter. In an order shortly after that ruling came down, a federal judge in Delaware said the case would proceed to trial on June 3rd. Judge Mary Ellen Noreika, who was appointed to the bench by former President Donald Trump, later denied another bid to dismiss the case that challenged the constitutionality of the central gun charge. The president's son is accused of lying in 2018 about his drug use on a form to buy a gun that he kept for about 11 days in Delaware. I'm Norman Hall.
The U.S. Senate has passed a $105 billion bill designed to improve air safety and customer service for air travelers a day before the law governing the Federal Aviation Administration expires. The bipartisan bill now goes to the House, which is out of session until next week. The Senate has also passed a one-week extension that would give the House time to pass the bill while ensuring the FAA is not forced to furlough around 3,600 employees. The bill stalled for several days this week after senators from Virginia and Maryland objected to a provision that would allow an additional 10 flights a day to and from the heavily trafficked Reagan-Washington National Airport. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barthi in Washington. Today is Friday, May 10th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The Africa Fertilizer and Soil Health Summit concludes in Nairobi.
The most productive way and the most affordable way forward is for us to start investing in organic fertilizer in our country.
The number of deaths due to recent floods in Kenya nears 240. Somalia calls for an end to the UN assistance mission in Somalia before next November. Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces and allied militias are accused of killing thousands of people in West Darfur state. A senior Zimbabwe official says corruption is hurting the economy.
Corruption remains one of the greatest barricades to the resuscitation of an economic thriving Zimbabwe.
And today, Friday, is World Lupus Day. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Chad's junta chief, Mohamed Idriss Deby Itno, won this week's presidential election in the first round, according to provisional official results released on Thursday, extending his family's decades-long grip on power. Monday's vote aimed to end 3 years of military rule in a country crucial to the fight against jihadism across Africa's Sahel desert region. Malawi's agriculture minister says the most productive and cost-effective way for African governments and farmers to deal with the high cost of imported fertilizer is to invest in organic fertilizer. Sam Kawale spoke Thursday following the conclusion of the Africa Fertilizer and Soil Health Summit in Nairobi, Kenya. He tells me that he believes African governments and farmers have been brainwashed into believing that all inorganic fertilizer is better than organic fertilizer.
The three-day summit brought together African countries who signed a budget declaration where they made commitments to increase the fertilizer use but also reduce soil degradation in their countries. And for us as Malawi, we took time to give our narrative on what we have done over the past couple of years to increase the uptake of fertilizer or the challenges we're having in the usage of fertilizer, and at the same time, what we are doing to make sure that we are reducing land degradation but also improve soil health.
Minister, does Malawi have its own fertilizer company or companies, or do you import fertilizer? I'm asking this question because sometimes I read that farmers complain that fertilizer prices are too high.
Although we have two companies that do the blending, but 100% of the fertilizer, the chemical fertilizer, is imported. However, as a country, we've been working on how we can start producing our own fertilizer. We have some companies that are coming to start mining some of the components in the fertilizer. But even though the investment is pretty high, our focus, and this is what almost every country that did the presentation today, they made a commitment to start using organic fertilizer because that is what is needed to make our soils healthy. A lot of farmers are complaining that the fertilizer prices are high, but the most productive way and the most affordable way forward is for us to start investing in organic fertilizer in our country.
My parents are subsistence farmers, and as far as I understand, they did not use or did not have to worry a lot about fertilizer. If they did, it was self-made. So what's the difference between my parents and agriculture today?
I strongly believe that we've been brainwashed to believe that chemical fertilizer is better than organic fertilizer. Unfortunately, that brainwashing has led us to lose a lot of money through imports of fertilizer, and that also has led to soil degradation because the nutrients in the soil are no longer there. We are reaping the fruits of our being brainwashed to believe that what our parents and grandparents were doing was bad. But after realizing that what our parents and grandparents were doing was good for food production, We are now going back to the basics and encouraging every farmer, you are supposed to be using organic fertilizer because we need that organic matter back in the soil.
Sam Kawale is Malawi's Minister of Agriculture. He spoke with me from Kenya's capital, Nairobi. With deaths nearing 240 and about 235,000 people displaced, Kenyans are mourning their lost loved ones and trying to rebuild after weeks of heavy rains that resulted in deadly floods and landslides. And it's not over yet, as more rain is expected through June. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has this report.
At Mathare North Primary School, Beatrice Achieng has been preparing food the past 2 weeks for the hundreds of flood victims who are being sheltered in this internally displaced people campsite. She's with Tushinde Children's Trust, a charity working in Nairobi's Mathare and Kiambu informal settlements.
They are living here, almost 300 people. And I'm only able to feed 200. There's a county government organization bringing food called Dish in a County. They are also helping us.
Monica Musioka came here after losing her home in the recent floods. Her four children are not able to go to classes.
We hope government will help us with the books to build classes so that our children may return to school to continue learning.
This week, Kenya President William Ruto, who visited the Mathare area, said $7.6 million will be used to rebuild all the schools affected by the floods before reopening them. Also, his administration plans to compensate the victims for 3 months.
Alewote, households, 1040 hapa Nairobi.
All the 40,000 households that have been displaced by floods in Nairobi, the government will give them 10,000 shillings so they can settle somewhere as they wait for the government to sort them out.
Back at the camp, another victim, Felix Ocheng, told us it was around 10 p.m. when the water started flowing into his home 2 weeks ago. He says that while this place is not ideal, he has nowhere else to go.
We can't go back because our house is marked for demolition 30 meters from the river. Everything will be demolished.
In the Mathare area, some homes that have been built along the river are already being brought down. Meanwhile, Peter Murger, Kenya Red Cross Disaster Risk Reduction Manager, says what's happening in neighboring countries also directly affects Kenya. He also says more people may be displaced if more dams overflow. For now, keep an umbrella handy, as this week's forecast says rain is still expected in many parts of the country, but the storms won't be as intense as they've recently been. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, May 10th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. The Somali government has written to the United Nations Security Council requesting the termination of the UN Assistance Mission in Somalia, also known as UNSAM, by next November. In a letter dated May 5th, Foreign Minister Ahmed Mualim Fiki said the Somali government will no longer request the renewal of the mandate of the UN resolution that created the mission. Haroun Maruf of VOA Somali Service asked UNSAM spokesperson Ari Gaitanis for his reaction.
Well, Haroun, let me say this. This latest development is a testament to the valuable work of UNSAM in support of the Somali authorities these past years. You know, as I'm sure you know, UNSAM is in Somalia on a mandate from the UN Security Council. And like all special political missions, you know, when its mandate ends, when its tasks are achieved, or there's a decision that it's no longer required. I should mention also, tied into this, there was a strategic review of UNSAM about 2 years ago now. In that review's findings, it did say that they recommended that UNSAM begin planning a transition from UNSAM to the UN country team, taking over its responsibilities. And the Security Council actually endorsed this finding in one of its resolutions. So right now, we're in discussions with the federal government of Somalia. We stand ready to follow the instructions of the council, and of course, we remain committed to partnering and supporting the government as we can and as required. And Harun, I should also mention, just to be very clear, this is specifically referring to UNSOM. The UN family, agencies, funds and programs, and UNSOS remain in place, and the support of the UN for Somalia will continue regardless of what happens to UNSOM or not.
Did the Somali government communicate officially with you about this?
We became aware of the letter sent overnight, and again, we're in discussions now, of course. We're engaging.
Why do you think the Somali government took this decision?
That's a question for you to pose to the Somali government, I would say.
So they say they have other strategic priorities. What do you think those priorities are?
Arun, I'll say it again. We're here on a mandate of the Security Council to support the government in its priorities. So it's a question, I think, best directed to the Somali government. You know, again, we stand here ready to support, and that's always been our approach.
Do you share the opinion that this office, the UN political office in Somalia, is no longer needed in Somalia?
Harun, I'm a UN official, so I don't have any opinion as such. I am here to serve. So in terms of what I think or don't think, it's really up to Security Council and the Somali government. Again, we're on a mandate here of the Security Council, and we will do whatever we're required to do. But my opinion, I don't think, is really important here.
Ari Gaitanis is the spokesperson for the UN Assistance Mission in Somalia. He spoke from Mogadishu with Harun Maruf of the Somali's Language Service. Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, the RSF, and allied militias killed thousands of people in West Darfur state and committed crimes against humanity and genocide, according to a report released today by Human Rights Watch. Jean-Baptiste Galopin, a co-author of the report, tells Viz Caravan Dam that the information is based on over 10 months of research with several trips made to Chad, Kenya, and South Sudan.
People describe how the RSF and allied militias, beginning in late April, carried out relentless waves of attacks against Masalit majority neighborhoods of El Geneida. There were some Masalit armed groups, and so these forces clashed with the Masalit armed groups, but they also targeted the civilian population of these neighborhoods as a whole. And they also systematically targeted the sites hosting displaced people. And so during these attacks, the RSF and militias carried out widespread killing, as well as other severe abuses such as rape and torture and looting.
It's hard, to get in there because it's very dangerous, and there just isn't a lot of reporting coming out of that actual area of Darfur especially. So who did you talk to?
So we spoke with over 220 survivors and witnesses and other people from El Geneida. We also interviewed humanitarians as well as some Arab residents of El Geneida. You know, we spent a lot of time in the camps in East of Chad where, you know, the totality of Masalit from El Geneida have fled in June and July and August. So, you know, these people, it was really horrific. I mean, we're used to researching conflicts, and, it's rare that everyone you meet, like we found in Adre in Eastern Chad, has, you know, witnessed multiple killings, often large-scale killings. And, you know, you see children who've been shot deliberately by forces. You know, you see people who've survived multiple massacres.
For those who aren't familiar with El Geneida, the Masalites make up more than half of that population there. Why is this fighting going on, and why is RSF attacking these people?
So the context of West Darfur is one in which there's been tensions and competition between various communities, and that's the backdrop of already the conflict in Darfur in the 2000s, with a basic fault line between the sedentary farming populations, including Masalit. These populations are primarily non-Arab, and Arab communities who are nomadic. And so there's been, you know, longstanding tensions over pasture and land in the context of migration, especially since the 90s of Arabs from Chad in particular into Darfur.
That is Human Rights Watch senior researcher Jean-Baptiste Galopin, co-author of the new report. He was speaking with my colleague Caravan Dam from Paris. The RSF could not be reached immediately for comment. In the past, the RSF has denied carrying out atrocities in Darfur. Zimbabwe's Prosecutor General, the former head of the country's Anti-Corruption Commission, says fraud, graft, and mismanagement is costing the country nearly $2 billion annually and devastating the economy and ordinary citizens. As Columbus Mavunga reports, it is the first time a senior Zimbabwean official has made such an accusation publicly.
Revelations this week by Prosecutor General Lois Matanda Moyo that billions of dollars are leaving Zimbabwe through illicit deals have contradicted the narrative of other government officials. They have often blamed economic challenges on targeted sanctions over election rigging and human rights abuses. At a training workshop for government officials in Harare Tuesday, Matanda Moyo called for immediate action.
Corruption remains one of the greatest barricades to the resuscitation of an economic thriving Zimbabwe. It is estimated that Zimbabwe, we are losing $1.8 billion annually due to corruption.
No one from the government has responded to her accusations. Economist Gift Mgano says Zimbabwe's annual revenue losses to corruption are too much, adding that even the World Bank hasn't allocated that amount to Zimbabwe within 1 year period ever. In fact, Mgano calls the $1.8 billion losses underestimated.
Remember that $1.8 billion is just illicit financial flows leaving the country. We also have a large chunk of internal corruption, which averages around $1 billion every year, which is reported by the Auditor General every year.
VOA reached to Zimbabwe's Anti-Corruption Commission with questions, but they remained unanswered. John Maketo is program manager at the Zimbabwe Coalition on Debt and Development, a non-profit organization that fights for social economic justice. He says a moribund economy, inadequate regulatory oversight, and legislative loopholes create a breeding ground for corruption.
The fact that we've got a whole commission, an anti-corruption commission, is not enough. The commission must be supported with strong and sound systems in terms of prosecution of corruption cases.
Since coming to power in 2017, President Emmerson Mnangagwa has promised to deal with corruption. Mnangagwa, however, has faced criticism for the government's alleged system of arresting but then acquitting suspects with connections to the president. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
At least 5 million people globally have a form of lupus. This is according to the World Lupus Federation, which says that autoimmune disease largely affects women of childbearing age. Systemic lupus, which is the most common form of the illness in the world, is prevalent and severe among people of African descent. Maureen Ojiambo reports.
Data from the World Lupus Federation indicates that 90% of people living with the disease are women. Despite the number being higher in women, men, children, and teenagers develop the condition as well. Most people with lupus develop the disease between the ages of 15 and 44. Lupus being an autoimmune disease means that the immune system attacks the body's different system and produces antibodies that attack the body's own tissue, causing inflammation. Frederick Otieno is a rheumatologist at Aga Khan University Hospital in Nairobi.
Lupus is about 9 times as common in women as compared, and only about 1 in 15 cases begin after the age of 50. There are rare cases of lupus in children, and most of the times it's unusual before the age of 5. If you have lupus, there's about 1 in 100 chance that your child could develop it in the course of their lifetime.
People with lupus can experience significant symptoms such as pain, extreme fatigue, hair loss, cognitive issues, and physical impairments that affect their daily lives. Many suffer from cardiovascular diseases, stroke, disfiguring rashes, and painful joints.
So the presentation of lupus is varied, and it can affect many different parts of the body. And when internal organs such as the heart, lung, brain, kidneys are involved, it can be more serious.
Some people with lupus are more at risk of developing blood clots in the veins or arteries.
The Center for Disease Control, CDC, says researchers are still studying the possible causes of lupus. However, the CDC says there is a genetic factor among the reasons that cause the illness. Women can develop lupus during their childbearing age when estrogen levels are high. Winnie Opondo is an advocate for a cure and a resource mobilization manager at the Lupus Foundation of Africa. She says it took doctors 6 years to diagnose her condition.
I remember before my diagnosis, I really was treated for bacterial infection several times. I think antibiotics mainly by name. And another time it was magnesium deficiency. I was diagnosed with peripheral neuropathy. There's pneumonia and even diabetes. I think because it's something that is still considered a rare condition.
The World Lupus Federation says many people with the illness take steroids like prednisone to help reduce inflammation. However, steroids can cause many side effects, and people who take them for a long time are also at risk for other serious health problems like diabetes. For VOA Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in San Francisco.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with basketball. The second round of the 2024 Sahara Conference got underway at the Dakar Arena on Thursday. The last six games of the conference is expected to determine the remaining three playoff spot of the 2024 BAL season. Tunisian champions U.S. Monastery defeated APR of Uganda 83-70 in the first game played on Thursday. Both APR and U.S. Monastery returned to action on Saturday after a rest day on Friday. In the other game, Rivers Hoopers of Nigeria suffered their first defeat when they lost 56-54 points to host AS Douanes. With the win, the host of the 2024 Sahara Conference improved their record to 2-1-2. A total of 12 clubs are taking part in the BAL qualifying tournament, divided into three groups of four teams each, with matches played in three different countries: Egypt, South Africa, and Senegal. In athletics, the second edition of the International School Sports Federation World Schools Cross Country Championships will be hosted by Kenya at the Ngong Racecourse this Sunday, May 12, 2024. Over 400 students from over 20 countries have confirmed their participation. The one-day event will see athletes compete in three categories, namely the under 12, under 15, and under 18 boys and girls races. Hassan Douali is the chairman of the local organizing committee for the championships.
This event is not about sporting only. It is cultural, it is bonding, it is friendship activities. It is student, centered activities, learning opportunity. And therefore, we want them to have an impression about the country. And therefore, we have lined a number of events.
In motorsports, reigning African rally champion Kiran Patel will be seeking to launch his title defense on Friday when the Pearl of Africa rally flags off in Jinja City, Uganda, with a super special stage at Bujagali Falls. The three-day event is the opening leg of the six Africa Rally Championships races and has five scoring points in the ARC category. Patel, who missed last year's Pearl of Africa's rally, says it will be very important to make a good start on Friday in this super special stage.
Yeah, preparations have been good. Always ready, always well prepared, I think, and we hope for a good finish.
In football news, Guinea booked their place at the men's Olympic football tournament in Paris after Elias Morabe's penalty sealed a 1-0 playoff victory over Indonesia on Thursday. The midfielder's first half strike from 12 yards proved the difference at Clairefontaine as the Seal Nationals secured qualification for just their second Olympic Games. With the 16-team lineup for this summer's event now complete, Guinea have been drawn in a daunting Group A alongside hosts France, USA, and New Zealand. And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, May 10th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.